You're listening to the ESP, the European Skeptics Podcast, an independent weekly show set out to bring you news, interesting topics and interviews with people mostly from Europe, building bridges and breaking down language barriers to show the world how active and awesome the skeptical movement is in the region. This is episode 420. I'm your host, Andreas Pinter, and joining me for the show is my co-host, Pontus Böckmann. See ya!
Hejsan, hejsan! 420, that is 10 times the answer to the question of the universe and everything, whatever that question was.
It
was
oh, so, I'm ashamed of not having thought of that.
So but now yeah, we know correct. 10 times the truth of the... What is the actual question?
The life, the universe, and everything.
Life, universe, and everything. That's right. Okay, so now we know.
Yeah, actually, I don't know if I've ever told you that, but in my hometown, there was a little community of skeptics and science enthusiasts, and a lot of them used to work at Videoton, which is a big electric supply manufacturing company that used to be really big, even in the old era. Mm-hmm. And during the times of communism, a lot of people did have jobs, but not have too much work on their hands. Yeah. So they had lots of time on their hands. So these highly intellectual people came up with a very fun way to entertain themselves. And they put together a numeric alphabet, and not only alphabet, but a numeric dictionary. So they used numbers to go with special meanings. Like in the study circle, the astronomical study circle of my hometown, it's still going on. So we are still greeting each other using numbers instead of saying
hello. So you are basically numerologists now.
Yeah. And the reason why I'm mentioning this is because 42 stands for fuck you.
Oh.
Yeah, it's basically...
Didn't know that. You.
So, and it comes from Douglas Adams's Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Ah. Yeah, and things like that. Yeah, the general greeting is just 49. Yeah.
I'm sure we can link to the full dictionary if people are interested.
Yes, we can. Yes, yeah. Actually, we can. I can send you the
Let's
link.
Do that. Let's do that.
Okay. All right. So, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Very well. I have actually a correction from last year. Last week.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so I had some listener feedback. It was a friend of mine who had a comment and pointed something out about the song Losing My Religion by REM, which we mentioned last week. I've never given that song much thought, though. But apparently the lyrics are not to be taken literally, and it's not about becoming an atheist at all. So I had to look that up just to make sure. I don't want us to be wrong on this podcast. So according to Michael Stipe of the band REM,
okay,
to lose one's religion is an expression from the south of the US, and it means to lose one's temper or to lose one's civility. So he has apparently over the years always had to correct people who thought that the song is about losing religion. It's about losing your shit, basically. So I'm so angry, I'll lose my religion. That means you're losing your temper. That doesn't mean...
Interesting.
Yeah. I haven't analyzed the text more thoroughly since last week, so I don't know if it makes sense in the context. But and I guess also you should always feel free to interpret art any way you want to, regardless of what the creator meant. But if we go by the man himself, the song is not about becoming an atheist. So I wanted to point that out.
Yeah, okay. That's really interesting because I've always interpreted it as such.
Well, it's pretty natural, right?
I mean, not specifically becoming an atheist, but like your religious faith or your grounding somewhat shaken.
Yeah.
Yeah, but this is what we like about art, I think, that it could have several different connotations, underlying meanings for people, depending on what background they come with. But also, for a skeptic, it's very important to distinguish between art and reality. So, yeah, it's not a documentary.
No, it's not. And actually, I want to mention something else. My father was an artist, a painter, As some people may know. And he was pretty mean when people wanted to know what his pictures were all about. So, you know, at exhibitions and you get to meet the artist himself and you talk about that. So what actually did you mean by this painting? What does it represent? And he always answered, well, what do you think it represents? He never gave a clue. He never wanted to tell what he was thinking about because that was not the point, he said. I have my ideas. And sometimes it's just inspiration and I don't even know. But I'm not here to tell you what it's about. And he said one thing too, and I think I'm trying to paraphrase this, which he actually put in print somewhere. So if pictures could be explained by words, art would not be necessary. I guess that was his take on it.
Wow. That's very meaningful.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Now we're talking about dads and family. I've grown up with a dad who's always been very enthusiastic about poetry. So I'm not sure my love for poetry comes from that. But I do share that love. And it's really interesting. And I love fiction as well. But it's always different from what we interpret as reality. But this is what used to bug me even at high school. I don't know if in your school system, your curriculum, there is something like the interpretive analysis of poetry.
Oh, yes. But we were exposed to that, which was always very annoying, I think.
Yeah. I found it annoying too. I mean, I kind of always liked playing around with ideas regarding the interpretations, but I've never really taken them as facts. So like, how the hell would I know what the poet thought and whoever wrote something down really thought? I mean, in a documentary, in an essay, in a philosophical essay, it's easier. But in fiction and in poetry, it's much, much more difficult. But that makes it probably even more interesting. Yeah, I've been trying to find a way to segue to the other thing that I'd like to mention, but I'm afraid I'm at a complete failure here. So I'll just jump right into it. I'd like to mention the Princess of Wales and her announcement a couple of days ago that while going through an abdominal surgery, which was a major abdominal surgery, as she phrased it in the announcement, turned out that she had cancer as well. Everyone is now jumping to conclusions that it could be a colon cancer or something, which might be the case, but they decided not to reveal any more information. However, the reason why I'd like to mention this, apart from the fact that she is now the second person in the royal family of the United Kingdom who's been diagnosed with cancer, what's very important about her announcement is that she made it clear that she's now undergoing chemotherapy treatment as a precaution.
Real medicine.
For the future, which is real medicine and which is always recommended. And I wish my mother had that when she had colon cancer.
Yeah.
And she was recommended that I try to convince her to undergo that treatment. She decided not to. She outright refused to do that. She would ignore every kind of medicinal device on that. And a couple of years later, we lost her last year. So
very sad.
Yeah, it is very sad. And it probably could have been avoided. And with such an important public figure like Princess Catherine making such an announcement, I think it sends the right message out. That this is important. It's important. She did mention it, I think, in the video, to make sure you have yourself checked out regularly. That's an important message. And this is something that I'd like to applaud the Princess of Wales for. That's responsible attitude from someone of that very high acclaim. So,
well, especially since the royal family isn't famous for always condemning alternative treatments, especially, of course, Charles has been very supportive of all kinds of nonsense over the years, which we've talked about a lot.
Yeah. So this is a bit of a deviation from that route, and we applaud that. And of course, we wish the Princess of Wales a speedy recovery and a full recovery as well. All right. Yeah, there are only the two of us here.
Sadly,
as per Onika's announcement on last week's episode, but this is temporary. So bear with us, people. You have to live with the fact that there are only two of us now, but Annika will be back in a couple of months once she's got everything sorted and her life gets back to normal. Sometimes life just gets in the way. So with the two of us present, we'd like to give you the usual regular episode with all kinds of goodies. And the first of those is Twitch, also known as This Week in Skeptical History. The beginning of this week, which was the 25th of March, marks the 213th anniversary of something that happened, well, with someone who's a big name in poetry, and that is Percy Bysshe Shelley. I had to look up the pronunciation of his middle name because I've never really known how to pronounce it. So apparently it's Bysshe.
Yeah, no, it looks very strange. Bysshe. So B-Y-S-S-H-E. I didn't know that.
Yes.
That's unusual.
So I'd always been circling around things like Bysshe or Bysshe or something. But apparently it's simply Bysshe.
Okay.
So Percy Bysshe Shelley. So it's not about the usual way we celebrate people, like based on their birthdays. It's not his birthday. His birthday is in August. But on the 25th of March 1811, he was expelled from the University of Oxford after, well, less than a year of having been student there. Apparently, he had been always very bored at the university. Based on his biographies, he never really attended any of the lectures given by the teachers and stuff. So he was just too bored. Intellectually, it wasn't as interesting for him. However, he got into a conversation with a friend of his who went by the name Thomas Jefferson Hogg, who accidentally sat down next to him in the dining hall at the university. And they ended up chatting, which resulted eventually in a pamphlet they probably wrote together. The pamphlet was published under the very enigmatic name, and I quote, "Through deficiency of proof, an atheist," end quote. Ooh. So that was the signature at the end of the pamphlet, which was about 13, 14 pages long, so not a very long one. It bore the title, "The Necessity of Atheism."
Ah, we can't have that. I mean, it's okay if you don't show up for class, but if you're starting to spread atheism, then we kick you out.
Exactly, especially at the beginning of the 19th century. It resulted in his expulsion from the university as well, where he never could go back afterwards. The pamphlet was all about the lack of evidence for the existence of any kind of God. And they elaborated on that, and there was a suggestion made as well that God was basically a large collection of projections of human ideas instead of reality. Because, in fact, we do not have compelling evidence that such a being exists.
Seems right to me.
Yeah, absolutely. So from a skeptical point of view, I think it really made a lot of sense. You have to understand that Thomas Jefferson Hogg and Percy Bysshe Shelley's friendship, which was based on their conversation, their initial conversation on German literature, which they ended up admitting to each other they had no knowledge about whatsoever. But they still ended up debating it. So it was like an intellectual exercise. And this is what the basis for the necessity of atheism was as well. It was an intellectual exercise for the both of them. We don't know to what extent Hogg was involved in the actual writing of it, but based on their friendship and based on the nature of their relationship, we have to assume that he had a lot to do with it.
Were they both kicked out?
They were both kicked out, yeah. Ah. However, Hogg didn't end up being as famous as Shelley, so this is why everyone is talking about Shelley's expulsion.
Yeah, it takes more than getting kicked out of school to be famous, I guess.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. This is why I'm not famous either. So, yes, I wish I had something of that importance to show for my expulsion from university, but no, However, going back to what they did, after writing the pamphlet, they started spreading the word. I mean, they gave copies to people and they sent them off to religious leaders, to university leaders, and all kinds of intellectuals in the hope that they would get a reply with actual arguments in favor of God that are more compelling than whatever they dug up. So instead, they had to have been a little bit naive in that regard, I think, to think that that would generate that kind of reply. And as you would think, it didn't. Instead, they ended up being kicked out. And initially, he had thought that his father would be very compassionate and understanding about the fact that he's standing up for what he believes in and what intellectual rigor he could apply for the question of the existence of God. Well, he ended up being debated by his own father, who was a devout Christian. So their relationship was really heavily hit by that fact, and eventually they parted ways. So his very, very short, yet full of challenge and full of excitement kind of life started around then, well, with the hasty marrying of a girl called Harriet Westbrook as well. Harriet Westbrook was 16 years of age when they got married, and that resulted in the two fathers, Westbrook and Shelley, joining forces in cutting them off from their respective families. So he got into a lot of trouble for expressing his doubts about God. That's the bottom line of this. Yeah, and obviously the 25th of March 1811 marks that real turning point when he got kicked out, along with Hogg. I think we can assume that he was a real skeptic back then.
Yeah, I think so. I think also that the skeptic dog that you have in the background agrees with us.
Yes, I'd like to apologize to our listeners. I'm afraid you won't be able to get rid of most of that from the background. It's an unusual thing for us to make daytime recording. And in the evening, yep, especially when it's dark, the dog is usually hiding and sleeping and not very active. In front of the house, there's not much going on in the evenings. Whereas now there are cars, people walking by, so the dog is constantly excited. Really sorry about that. I apologize to everyone. But this is our skeptic dog, Mitsuke. So why don't we move on to the news?
Yes, let's do that. Andras, I am so happy. I cannot help it. It is a scientific fact that I am happy. It's all in the papers.
Good for you.
The 2024 World Happiness Report is out to prove that Scandinavians, and Finns in particular, for some reason, are the happiest peoples in the world.
Mm.
So, yeah, very interesting to read that in the news. World Happiness Report, or the WHR, is a partnership of Gallup, the Oxford Wellbeing Research Center, the UN Sustainable Development Solutions Network, and the WHR's editorial board. And this is, I believe it's the 12th year that this report has come out, but they have been looking into this subject or into this topic since 2005. And the four top countries when it comes to happiness in the world is Finland, first place, Denmark, second place, Iceland, third place, and Sweden, fourth place. And Sweden has made a jump from last year, from sixth place to fourth place.
Okay, are you guys on some kind of recreational drugs, or it has something else to do?
I don't think we need any drugs. We're just happy as we are. Also, Norway is up there. They're on seventh place, so pretty clear that Scandinavians are the happiest people in the world. So what is this and how do they come to these conclusions? To get stable values, first of all, they average out the last 3 years. They do this every year and then they average the last 3 years to get some sort of consistency, I guess. And this explains, for instance, why Israel, who we wouldn't right now associate with happiness, they are still on number five, but it also may be that they this is a survey, I'm coming to that, but there's a survey behind this, and it can have been filled in before the tragic events that started in October last year. So we have Israel up there, Netherlands is up there, Luxembourg, Switzerland, and Australia also. Shout out to Richard Saunders, first time that they made the top 10, I think. On the other hand, you don't want to live in Afghanistan, Lebanon, Lesotho, or Sierra Leone, because they are on the bottom there, 143rd place for Afghanistan, for example. There's lots of statistics in this study, and they found a lot of things, and I cannot get into all of them. But younger people are generally less happy compared to older people, which is a shift in the trends. Maybe it's because of the outlook of climate crisis and things that are making younger people not so as happy as before. Maybe it's social media. I don't know. The US has for the first time fallen out of the top 20 list. And another thing they found is that the difference between West and East Europe is narrowing. It used to be that the West European countries or peoples were more happy than East European countries. And it's still the case, but the gap is narrowing. We will link to the full report. You can see all of these things. But I was interested in how in the world do you measure happiness? Do you just ask people how they feel? And yes, sort of, they do that. According to the WHR, the scores are based on individuals' own assessment of their lives. They are using something called the single item Cantrell ladder life evaluation, which I don't know anything about, but they compare that to, it's roughly how epidemiologists estimate how life expectancy is affected by things like smoking, exercise and diet, things like that. So it's a self-assessment survey, which has its problem always. Of course, there could be cultural differences. Maybe people in certain countries will not admit to being happy for some reason. Maybe it's not something that you should say out loud. We don't know. But we also want to know why people, let's assume that this is more or less correct then. Why are certain people more happy than others? What makes people happy? That's the million-dollar question. So what they did was they saw if they could tie differences in happiness scores to certain fundamental factors. So they looked at six variables, and these are the same variables that they usually look at. So it's GDP per capita, social support, meaning if you have friends to rely on, healthy life expectancy, freedom. I think it's about, they defined it as freedom to make life choices. And then generosity, if they perceive the environment to be generous. And also perception of corruption, which I thought was interesting because Scandinavian countries are very low in corruption. So maybe that has something to do about it. If you can trust your government, if you can trust authorities around you, then maybe you feel happier or less unhappy, I guess. So what they did is they made a correlation between these factors and the happiness score. And they found that 33% of the differences in happiness between countries can be linked to GDP per capita. So I guess money makes you happy. So it's simple as that. Social support was almost as important. 27% of the differences was explained by that. And then healthy life expectancy was 15%, freedom 12%, generosity only 3%, so maybe not that important. Perception of corruption was 10%, so that explained 10% of the differences.
Can I have a question?
Yeah.
When we're talking about social support, does it include support from the state as well, or it's your social circles that mainly refers to?
For what I saw, I didn't see all the questions, but from what I saw, my conclusion was that it's more your local, your neighbors, your family and friends, the social support. Mm-hmm. Who do I call when something happens? Can I trust that? Am I afraid of dying alone in my apartment and nobody will find out about it? Things like that. Now I'm just speculating, but that kind of thing. If you have people around you, people you can call, then you are probably a little happier than if you are all on your own.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, so interesting information, or some of it is speculation, I guess, but you can see correlation between certain things and interesting. And I'm very happy to be happy, of course. That's why I had to talk about it.
And I am very happy for you, especially because being a Hungarian, well, we rank 56 on that list.
Yeah.
So we are not very high up there. So being happy for you for being happy is my way of getting out of the misery that being a Hungarian means.
Also, I forgot to mention, there's one a little bit dark cloud on this. Apparently, Sweden's rise in the table from 6th to 4th place, it is actually not that we are getting happier, it's that the rest of the world is getting more miserable. So, yeah, it was a little bit of that. So the score didn't actually increase, just our place on the table increased a bit. Too bad.
Yeah, as I browse through the list, there are a couple of very interesting things. Mm. For example, China being 60th. So even though it's a very prosperous country and people are better off than they used to be, like, let's say 20 years ago, they're still not up there. And Russia is 72nd. So, yeah, it looks like even though Russians give their support to people who are not deserving of that support, like Vladimir Putin, who just got elected for his 5th term, they don't seem to be overly happy.
Yeah.
Well, for the aforementioned factors, I think.
Yeah, I mean, freedom is one thing, of course.
A lot of Russians are not very well off either.
Corruption
corruption.
Yeah.
But corruption can really deprive you in a way. Like, if you think that there is no meritocracy to hope for, to base your hope for success on, then nothing makes really sense. So it's like, well, whatever. I'll just try to make ends meet and leave you that there. And that's very depressing. Yeah, and when you're an activist or a person with activistic attitudes, then you can get even more depressed because you seek out that very thing that you try to do something about. And it feels like it's everywhere. It's always there. Corruption, pseudoscience in our case, all kinds of nonsense. When you actively seek it out to fight it, then you have to make sure that you have your sources of happiness to go by, because otherwise you just get depressed. All right. So now that I mentioned Russia, I have to say that Russian people, especially in Moscow, do have a reason to be unhappy at the moment. Probably everyone knows that on the 22nd of March, a couple of days ago, there was a terrible attack on a Moscow concert hall. And as of the day of this recording, there are close to 140 people announced and confirmed dead as a result of that attack. Authorities, Russian authorities, announced that at least 60 people remain in a serious condition, so the number of deaths could go even higher. So people went to attend a concert, and 4 people opened fire in the outer lobby of the building. And they then started fleeing, and they managed to go about 340 kilometers before they could be stopped. Now they are all in custody. The names suggest somewhat of, I'm not going to try to pronounce the names, somewhat Russian sounding, but some of them have a little bit of an Arabic sound to them. They seem to have originated, most of them, from Tajikistan. Obviously, it's important from a skeptical point of view that the Russian government and several state agencies jumped on the opportunity to blame everything on Ukraine.
Yeah.
Because these people were fleeing towards the south of Moscow, so the government could claim that they were trying to escape towards Ukraine. And then state media started hinting at Ukrainian ties as well, which Ukrainian authorities did deny. Well, I would have said obviously, but it's not necessarily obvious. But there is another thing that IS, the Islamic State, also claimed responsibility for that attack. So they released footage as well that showed the very same people, footage that was recorded from the point of view of the attackers. So this is very convincing evidence that they had something to do with it. That doesn't stop the Russian authorities and Russian media from spreading that kind of disinformation that it's obviously Ukrainians. And why are we so sure of that being disinformation? One of the reasons is because NTV TV channel, which is a part of Russian state propaganda, released a deepfake video a couple of days ago that featured, or supposed to have featured, Alexei Danilov, Secretary of the National Security and Defense Council of Ukraine. And, he sounds like he's celebrating the fact that this attack happened and tries to say that he has very high hopes that it will be more frequent in the future. But there is one problem with this. There is no actual footage with Danilov saying something like that. So the sound of his must have been AI generated. And his face was put in the video, was put in the place of the face of Kirilo Budanov, chief of Ukraine's defense intelligence. But that person didn't say anything like that either. The voice itself was computer generated and the face was replaced. And it wasn't even done in a very sophisticated way. So it's easy to spot. So experts spotted it right away. And the other thing is that the footage could be identified as something that was recorded a couple of days earlier than the attacks happened. So on the 16th of March. So it's definitely deepfake. And while we're talking about deepfake, it's going to be very important to be on the constant lookout for these deepfakes because they can be very manipulative. They can result in people becoming completely unsure about everything. So this is one of the reasons why the Russian state propaganda does that. They want to discourage you from forming your own opinion because of the uncertainties that come with those. So, yeah, I don't know what to think because these people are saying terrible things about this attack and they are Ukrainians, but the whole thing is deepfake. So deepfake is a major concern, especially because currently, out of the close to 50 countries or territories within the geographical boundaries of Europe, the European continent, there are 29 countries that are holding elections of some sort in 2014, including European Union parliamentary elections. So we are voting on our EPs this year. That is very important to be able to spot deepfake. A recent example is that in Slovakia, where a couple of days before the parliamentary elections of the country in September 2023, a fake AI-generated audio was released that was supposed to feature Michal Šimička, leader of the Progressive Slovakia Party. And he was supposed to discuss something with a journalist regarding how to rig the votes. That kind of message, that kind of fake audio is really capable of building distrust towards a person, right? So you would not cast your vote to that person. Luckily, it was quite obvious that it was faked, but it's not always that. So that is just one example, a very close example, but there could be lots and lots of others mentioned here. So be on the lookout for deepfakes, because not only the Russian government is using that to build distrust.
Yes, well, deep fakes are something that we have to get used to. That's something that's new. And to this day, we can still fairly easily spot it. But sooner or later, we will not be able to do that. But we also need to remember that there are old fashioned misinformation and that won't go away. An example of that is vaccination misinformation. So no matter how many times ideas are debunked, they're always coming back, especially on social media. And the latest example are rumors spreading on social media that Iceland has banned all COVID-19 vaccinations. That first spread late last year, but now people have for some reason found these old posts and they are reposting them and starting the spread again, even though it was confirmed many times that they are untrue. already in December. We knew that. And the background is that some anti-vaxxers have taken a few things out of context, not uncommon, and cherry-picked some statistics regarding excess deaths and put these together. So the message is that due to a spike in sudden deaths, quote-unquote, the government of Iceland has halted all COVID vaccinations. But that's not at all what happened. There are two things here that have been misrepresented. The first one is that Iceland actually did mostly stop administering COVID vaccines during the summer of 2023. But this was in order to help plan its autumn 2023 vaccination program for vulnerable people. So they just take the first part of that and put it out of context. The other thing is that way back already in October 2021, the Icelandic government did announce that the country would stop using the Moderna vaccine and use only the Pfizer vaccine instead, while more information was collected on the safety of that vaccine. So that was just one of the vaccines. And in any case, the Moderna vaccine is now back in use again. So that, but they take that and they put the, take the headlines out of the news and they put it together. So there's nothing to see here, but of course, anti-vaxxers again now in March 2024, they use these old headlines to try to give the impression that Iceland have discovered how dangerous these vaccines are and they have now stopped. And the health authorities on Iceland has time and time again gone out and denied this. This is not true. Don't listen to this. We are vaccinating, but of course, the anti-vaxxers do not link to those news.
Mm.
Yeah.
So from classical kinds of fake news to classical kinds of fake treatments. So pseudoscience is all over the place when it comes to healthcare. And acupuncture is one of those pseudoscientific treatments that I'm very happy to report. Even the Wikipedia article on acupuncture states outright. By the way, if you want to have a proper source on what's what regarding acupuncture, you go to Wikipedia, because that is one of those Wikipedia articles that are in a very good shape, very well researched, lots of factual information there. So it's a good source of information. This is very important, especially because in the UK, the current week is Acupuncture Awareness Week. And we can use that as skeptics to raise awareness about acupuncture not being a proper treatment either.
Yeah, so these are the acupuncturists try to push for acupuncture this week, but we can make them aware that, well, doesn't work.
Doesn't necessarily work, yeah. It's the British Acupuncture Council, which sounds like a very important authority, but it's a self-regulatory body for the practice of acupuncture in the UK. They have about 3,000 members, so it's a big organization, but it's still not an authority. We have to be aware of that. This Awareness Week, obviously, is for them about trying to get the message out. They organize lectures, all kinds of open days and stuff. But I'd like to use the opportunity to mention a couple of facts. So first of all, if you want to get a good understanding, just go to see the Wikipedia page. Or if you prefer the book format, one book that I would recommend to everyone is Trick or Treatment by Simon Singh and Edzard Ernst, because that gives you a pretty good overview of the, well, the then current available, reliable evidence on acupuncture. Because that's one of the problems with acupuncture. First of all, it's not one modality of alternative healthcare. It's not only something that we can understand as part of traditional Chinese medicine, because it exists already outside of TCM as well. And we know that TCM was basically blown out of proportion in the times of Mao Zedong. It's not that real as so many people would like it to be. But the problem is that there are thousands and thousands of published articles, even clinical studies on acupuncture. But the problem with them is most of them is of very poor quality. And there are systematic reviews as well, but some systematic reviews include those articles that have not been published in English, but published in Chinese. Because most acupuncture-related articles are published in Chinese. But we do know that China is famous for those so-called paper mills that don't publish papers based on real evidence, but fabricated data. It's really important to mention that, even though there seems to be, and if you ask an acupuncturist, they will definitely tell you that it works, it's effective, but the evidence is shaky at best. We should probably assume that they don't work. You should definitely not go for acupuncture instead of well-established, known to be effective treatments. So please be reasonable and try to assess it as such. So yes, do a little bit of research, do some reading. The Wikipedia article is not only factual, but very well written as well. It's a good read. Go on and give it a try, but give a try to Trick-or-Treatment by Edzard Ernst and Simon Singh as well, at least during this Acupuncture Awareness Week.
Yeah. I can also recommend looking at science-based medicine, because Steve Novella has written several times about acupuncture. And not just him, I think, but on that blog, there will be a lot of articles, well, several articles that are very good.
Yeah. All right. But that brings us to the end of our news segment, which means that we need to find out who's been really wrong or really right lately. So, Pontus, would you mind enlightening us about that?
Yes, absolutely. And this was a little bit of a roller coaster because I thought this was going to be a really wrong, but it turned out last minute that things worked out in the end. So we often blame EU for not achieving what we expect them to do. But sometimes, as I hinted on there, when you least expect it, they pull through and they actually do their jobs down there in Brussels. So this is about the European so-called Green Deal, which is a program that was adopted back in 2020. It has several legs. Some of it is about climate change, of course, climate being climate neutral by 2050. But part of it is also that by 2030, the EU should accomplish something they call the restoration of degraded natural areas. So to restore certain areas to their natural state for the benefit of the environment. There was an important vote about this part that was scheduled for Monday this week. This Monday was the 25th of March, but it was cancelled because several countries withdrew their support for it. Among them, I must admit with my shame, was Sweden. But on the other hand, Hungary was one of them as well. So we do apologize for our countries doing the wrong thing here. And
well, it's not our countries, it's our governments.
That's true. And it wasn't just those two countries. There were others as well. And it was more on the right wing, as normal, as you would expect. And all of this, I think, has to do with that it is a super election year this year. As you mentioned, Andras, we are voting for parliament in the EU this year, but there are other elections coming up as well. And that makes it very tempting for certain parties to be very populistic and do short-term things in order to gain votes. And we know what happens if you try to cross the French farmers, for instance. They just go into Paris and they dump manure all over the place. And this is sensitive and politicians don't like that. But so that it wasn't looking very good at the beginning of this week, but due to intense lobbying and as a surprise for many, including myself, the vote actually passed on Tuesday, the day after. And this was after several EPP members, and that's the, what do you call that? It's the group of parties, certain parties in the parliament, including the Irish delegation was specially mentioned. They broke ranks and they supported the deal when people didn't expect them to. So the text will now be put to a final vote in the Council of the EU. So everything is not done and dusted already. We will see what happens there. But there is now a chance that these rules can enter into real legislation, which we hope. So after this roller coaster, after these surprises, for sometimes surprising us, by actually doing their jobs, the EU Parliament gets this week's award for being really right.
and we applaud them to be right. It's funny how it happened yesterday. Like yesterday, we still thought that it would be the source of a really wrong award that we hand out to them. But now it's just changed to really right because of them doing the right thing.
Yeah.
So
there's always hope.
There's always hope. Yeah. But that basically marks the end of our show. However, we will come with a quote as well, even in the absence of Annika. But before we go, I'd like to ask for your help with spreading the word. Please leave us a review. 5 stars would be ideal. And if it's a text, a review text as well, with the explanation of why we are so awesome, that would even be more appreciated. Yeah. But you can help our work in several different ways as well.
Yes, you can go to patreon.com/theESP and see if you can help us financially, typically with a dollar or a euro per episode. And you can cap that as well, so you don't have to risk us releasing 30 episodes on a month. Not that we would do that, but you can decide how much you want to limit this per month. And you, of course, if you can't do that, that's very understandable, but you could also share our social media posts as well, because that increases the visibility, and that is also very good for us.
Yeah. And if you found something interesting, particularly interesting, and you want to comment on that, you can send us an email to info@theesp.eu, or even if it's about corrections, because we occasionally end up saying something that is not necessarily 100% true, but we would like to correct them because we don't want to spread misinformation. So that's very much appreciated. So please do so if you can. But here's our quote. The quote comes from, well, who else than Percy Bysshe Shelley? And it's an actual quote from the aforementioned The Necessity of Atheism pamphlet. And it's very short and sweet. It goes, "We must prove design before we can infer a designer."
Right.
Short and sweet.
Yep. Okay.
And
very
you can,
good.
You
very
can
good.
Apply that to other fields as well, not just religion and existence of God, a question of the existence of God, because you can think of acupuncture. You can think of homeopathy. Before you start explaining how it works, please try to show that there is an actual fact that needs explanation. I think it's very well said by Percy Bysshe Shelley.
Yes, indeed.
And with that, we say goodbye to our listeners. I'd like to thank you, Pontus, for this week.
Thanks a lot.
And thanks for the ongoing work of editing the show and all that as well. And many thanks to our listeners as well for tuning in. Please keep doing so. And until next week, goodbye.
Hej då.
Vislat.
Woof.
This has been your ESP experience. The show is produced and recorded by the ESP.eu. Join us again next time, but until then, please send your feedback, comments, or death threats to info@theesp.eu. We would also love to hear your ideas and suggestions regarding future episodes, as well as news from your country of residence that might interest others across the continent. If you have a local event or organization to promote, please don't hesitate to let us know, as we are more than happy to help. All music in the program was written and performed by Keisha J. Gray and George Schrab and is used with their permission. Please check out our webpage at www.theesp.eu, follow us on Twitter at @espodcast_eu, and like us on Facebook. I don't know how you can believe. So, but on the 25th of March, 1811,
the UN sustainable UN blah, blah, the UN sustainable the
Oh my god, that dog. Really sorry about that.
Our rumor... Sorry. Telephone. My backup is complaining that... it's automatic, so every hour or so it's set to back up to network drives. But for some reason, after the update, my computer couldn't find the network drives. So now every time it tries to do it, it complains and it plays a noise every time. And it just comes back. So I don't know where I was.
And now that I'm not talking, the dog... Ah, he's back. Okay.
Yeah, it always barks when you talk, not as much otherwise. Yeah. Barking at you.
Acupuncture awareness. Sorry.
Itzy! Kuschlein!